advice to young climbers who just keep being who you are as a climber, like make sure that's still your priority. And you could do the gigs with the sponsors, you could do the videos and the marketing campaigns and the silly this, silly that sometimes, but like that's part of that's the responsibility for sure. But try to keep your vision the way it was as genuine as it can be, because that'll create a longer lasting relationship with climbing for it for yourself, but also for the companies.
Hey, welcome to the Test Piece Podcast. This podcast is about all things high-level climbing. My name's Joshua Horsley. I've been climbing for 25 years, and I love staying at the cutting edge of climbing.
Hi, my name is Timothy Kang. I'm a pro climber, a coach, and a route setter, and climbing is my life.
We started the podcast to explore and articulate what it takes to climb at a high level, what it takes to go from good to great. Okay, let's start the podcast. All right, Tim, my dude, John, we got John Cardwell on the podcast. How's it going,
John,
you guys?
John Cardwell, what's up?
How's it going?
John, thanks for coming on, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you guys.
Dude, we're the excited. We're super psyched. We get to talk to you about all the cool things that you've been doing for your whole life. You're one of the best American sport climbers. You've also bouldered a little bit, like you've climbed, a hard boulder or two, maybe the game. I think people might have heard that.
I dabble.
It's all climbing. I got a question from Ethan Pringle, and I'm going to just say speaks for all of us. And he wants to know, John, have you ever done a backflip on a BMX bike?
I have not, nor have I attempted. Yeah.
Maybe Ethan was wrong. Did you used to do BMX when you were younger?
Yes, definitely. So, I rode a lot, for a number of years, and actually a few of my friends who we rode together, they moved on into the BMX world. Some were like sponsored athletes as riders in BMX, and a good friend of mine actually moved to, Los Angeles, and he's a photographer. I'll have to look up exactly who he shoots for, but it was Ride BMX for a while and a couple other brands and stuff. He's in that world basically, like Bearcam or something as to climbing. He does that for the BMX world. So it's kind of cool. So we still keep in touch every now and then, because they've done a couple traveling trips to Barcelona, because it's a big riding scene there also. And he would be there shooting, and I would be like in Sierrana, like an hour away, like climbing. And we never met up. It would have been really cool, because he was like, I would love to shoot climbing someday as shooting like BMX. It's like a lot of flashes and big wide fisheye lenses and really creative photography style, like urban photography. But he's always wanted to just jump into a climbing crag one day and just see what he could do.
Isn't it interesting how
so that's a random.
Yeah. Hopefully Ethan sent us a bunch of really good questions. So he'll pop up again. But isn't it interesting how it's like you had this crew, you guys were really good, and you went off and were really good at climbing. Like, it's always interesting how you get people together who are psyched and they just excel at something. And I'm going to say, BMX, probably good for, your head, your head game, in climbing, but probably not what I would maybe pick out as the best sport to do before climbing, as far as preparing your upper body or your fingers. But how'd you transition out of that and into climbing?
Well, actually, so BMX was maybe like a peer thing. So like my friends in school, probably from maybe elementary, I want to say, probably middle school, is when we really were like, oh, we ride bikes and, we go build dirt jumps, because we had a lot of open space in New Mexico, in Albuquerque at the time. So there was all these open lots where you could just like go build your dirt jumps and stuff. It was like really fun, like future housing developments, basically. We were always like devastated when we would like, leave for a week or something, come back and like the housing developers have like moved in and like cleared the land. And we're like, no, like months.
They probably
of hard
show
work,
up. You know? They probably show up and they're like, what the hell?
Yeah, they see all these dugout jumps or whatnot. So I did that like as a pure thing probably. And I obviously really enjoyed it. You know, like we built like custom BMX bikes and stuff. I had all the little magazines. So I did that probably through high school, but another huge part of my athletic life before climbing was skiing. And I have a pretty big background in skiing, and my family, my stepfather, and my stepbrother, specifically, he was on the U.S. ski team racing downhill for over 10 years. He went to the Olympics in Salt Lake City, and we got to see that. It was really cool. So I was just like, from a really young age, really inspired by skiing, and not only skiing, but at like an elite level. That was just like what I was exposed to. And my stepfather obviously was in skiing also, and he was a ski instructor in Taos, which is a pretty, really nice ski area in northern New Mexico. And it's kind of like a little more extreme and difficult mountain. I think a lot of people would agree. So on the weekends we would go skiing, and that was just all I knew. And they kind of just, it was crazy. Like they saw that I learned how to ski, and he taught me for maybe a year or something like that. And then the next season he was like, well, I'm off to work, and I showed interest. So they would just let me loose on the mountain like all day, you know, like maybe $5 for like some food or something like that. It was crazy. They were just like, be back at 2:30 or 3:00. And this is like early teens. And now that I think back on it, I was like, that's crazy. Like, what if something happened? Or I didn't really, there was no cell phone, or, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't really have a way to contact them or anything like that. I just knew that I had to be at the ski lodge or at the base of the mountain before the end of the day, and just kind of wait for them. Because so I just went nuts on the mountain for like a couple years, you know.
That is crazy that nothing nothing cool bad ever it? Happened.
No, I never got hurt skiing.
That you got to just when you were super young go to the Olympics and see someone you knew there, that really does, just from the very beginning, you're like, oh, I'd like to do that thing. I'd like to be in the Olympics and be an elite athlete. So that's a good way to start the path, man.
Yeah. And it probably subconsciously influenced me at a young age. Now that I think about it, I'm like, that's crazy. Like if I went to Olympics now for like a sibling, it would be like the most, like I would be like very proud and like super excited. I think we'll have to look back. When was Salt Lake? I think that was probably like 2002 or 2003.
Wow.
I think it was a long time ago. So I just barely started climbing, and it was very early on, I think.
I was going to,
so it didn't register too much with me at the time.
Yeah. So how old were you when you started climbing, and did you stop BMX or skiing for any specific reason other than that you started climbing and were putting your whole life into that?
Yeah. Well, as you guys know, like when I started climbing, I didn't put my whole life into it at first. You know, it was kind of this really fun, just like kind of wild experience for me. I found a lot of freedom in climbing, and I could kind of like, it felt like I could do kind of or try whatever I wanted to. There wasn't as many rules as like traditional sports. So I really latched onto that. So you think like mountain biking, skiing, climbing, they're all kind of similar in the sense that you could kind of choose your own path. I mean, with skiing, you eventually go into competitions or something like that. So it's kind of regulated. Same with climbing, but you can just go to the mountain and ski and become a really good skier, you know, and just kind of take your own path. So that being said, I started climbing when I was around 11, I think. It was either 10 or 11. And my mom had some coworkers who their kids were on like a climbing summer camp or program or something like that. It might have even been the team, like a youth team. And so she was trying to find stuff to like occupy me, because I had like a lot of energy. And of course I was like riding bikes, and this might have even been a little bit before like I was really into bikes, to be honest, and even skiing. I think those kind of came early teens as well. They all kind of came on at the same time. And what I would say is that climbing just lasted. Like, you know, with biking, as you know, I never got seriously hurt, but I, you know, I'd wipe out sometimes on the jumps, and like my wrist would really hurt, or my shoulder or something like that. And I would go into the gym and I was like, I can't climb the same. It hurts. And I'd take a week off. And that happened a couple times. And I was like, I would rather climb than get hurt on the bike, you know? And thankfully for skiing, I never got hurt. So skiing never really seemed like it got in the way. But once, you know, my stepfather, I think he stopped, he wasn't instructing in Taos anymore at a point of time. And so we just kind of stopped going as frequently, you know, so it kind of just faded out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm glad you stuck with climbing.
Yeah, me too. It was pretty clear. Yeah. Early on. Yeah.
So you grew up in New Mexico. Mm-hmm. And you know, I said you were, and I will say again, you're one of the best American sport climbers. What is it about sport climbing? Like, I feel like, Tim, I feel like one of our themes, like our sub themes, is that sport climbing's awesome and people don't do it that much anymore, especially in America.
Well, definitely an American culture. Definitely American. Yeah. And it's almost American. Like, yeah, this yeah. is like oh, a yeah. mystique behind sport climbing in that, like, I mean, first of all, I think there's a ton of misconceptions. So I would love to hear, mm-hmm. John, or just,
yeah, like, how'd you get drawn to it? Or, like, why do you think it's not as popular anymore? I mean, you know, is it, like, this the era? Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think, like, maybe, well, honestly, when I was younger, I was really into bouldering. You know, we had Waco Tanks not too far away, and it was basically in my backyard. So a lot of my early climbing trips and I don't know, like projects and stuff were Boulder Prom projects and in Boulder. And early on, I became friends with Daniel Woods. We competed. We were in the same region together. So we met each other. And at that time, he was really already excelling. So he was like kind of instrumental in my early climbing. He helped push me. And just by osmosis, I was like, if he's doing that, I should be doing that kind of thing. So I just kind of started following that trend. And then he was friends with Paul Robinson. So then we ended up all kind of being friends and traveling together and stuff. And those guys, as you know, they really were kind of boulders, and especially when they were younger, kind of focused in on bouldering. So that's kind of all we did when we were younger. And it was Daniel who still kind of dabbled in sport climbing. And Daniel and myself, we competed in sport climbing as youth climbers. So I think I saw that I was naturally more talented at sport climbing, or that I just felt more comfortable sport climbing. And then I would go bouldering with Paul and Daniel, say to Waco, and they were breaking into V12s, V13s, V14s eventually at a young age. And I was still kind of a little behind, you know, I was like doing V10s and V11s, and that was really good at the time. And, you know, I saw my progression, but I always saw that there was like a little bit of it was really hard to catch up to where those guys were pushing the bar, you know, and eventually I got there in certain regards, but at a certain point I was like, I like this sport climbing thing. And a lot of the magazines that I got when I was younger, climbing magazines, or, you know, eventually like online stuff, you know, I just found it more interesting, and I would like really soak it up, you know, like, the biography or dosage films and all that. I just love those parts of the films even more.
I got a hand
to you. Way to lean into the. Sorry, yeah, sorry, Josh. I think we're about to say the same thing.
I was actually going to say what interest. I wanted to give you credit for being around Daniel and Paul and being just like a little bit below when you were younger and not like giving up or taking that, like to randomly stumble into Daniel Woods and be like, oh man, this guy who's maybe one of the strongest climbers who has ever lived physically, right? I mean, his fingers and you know, it's really good to have that osmosis, but sometimes that can strike people down where they go like, well, you know, Daniel can do one arm pull-ups on 6 mil when he's 12 years old, and you know, I can't do that, so I'm never going to be great. And there's a mind game there too, where it can be a little tricky when you're younger, especially you haven't, you know, everyone, well, I mean, there's, you know, different times where you get stronger, you know, puberty and, who are we talking to? I won't name names. There's someone who is like 18 or 19, and we were talking about how you still get stronger after there. Sometimes some people really get quote unquote, I'm going to say adult strength. I don't want to get canceled. Adult strength. Like, I felt like my pinches got stronger later. That's interesting. Cause when I think of the history of sport climbing and then when Daniel and Paul kind of were hitting the scene, I always compared, this is just really random analogy, but kind of obvious, is there was Dave Graham and Chris Sharma. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Dave was the kind of thinner, tall guy. And I equated that to Paul and, you know, Sharma and Daniel.
Yeah.
And they were like the boulders though, right? It's like, this is bouldering. Like, and now, mm-hmm. yeah, you know, yeah. And now we've evolved to bouldering, but it's cool that you found your, you know, your, it's like, okay, like this is fun. But then, you know, you tap into what you really liked.
I mean, I will say that like, while those guys, they were really, kind of like pushing the bar higher for youth climbing, I would say, especially in that era. I was still like second, you know, so like, for instance, like Daniel and I would compete, he would be first, I'd be second, all the way up until nationals for like, I don't know, a number of years in a row, you know, or like I was third or second or something like that. And every now and then we would swap, you know, but only in like the sport climbing competitions. And actually at that time there was no bouldering events for youth climbers until you were like 15, then you can enter like ABS nationals or something like that. So we didn't have bouldering events, but it was outside that it was apparent where it was more apparent that Paul, Daniel, even we were good friends with Vasya Voronikov. He lives in Colorado now, but he was from New Hampshire, and they were all really, you know, strong, but Vasya was like a good sport climber. And so he kind of convinced, when we would get together, like Daniel, Vasya and I, we would go to Rifle. And those are kind of the trips that Paul wouldn't come along with as much, you know, at the time. And, but we'd spend like the summer in Rifle, go sport climbing, and, or we would go to Rumney or something like that. So sport climbing was always kind of there. And I think because that I was like close enough within reach that I was always motivated just to keep working harder. It never was at the point where I was like, I'll never catch up or I got discouraged. It was always a point of motivation when I would climb with Daniel. And then, you know, they were good friends too. So they were like super encouraging at the same time. Yeah, like, you can do it or try this or, you know, whatever, you know.
I feel like a total dick. Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to say you were below those guys. It's just sometimes when you're when you're super young.
I like, was though.
Well, yeah. But yeah, you definitely, you know, came into your own.
Yeah.
So
they constantly pushed me is all I'm saying, you know, and they probably only pushed me because they were kind of a step ahead, and I thrived off that. You know, I really, you know, if they had it, if I had passed a lot of people when I was younger, maybe I wouldn't have been as ambitious as I was. You know what I mean? So I always had the bar. I was never satisfied, let's put it that way, as a youth climber. I always wanted kind of a little bit more, no matter, you know, if I would reach a certain milestone. My good buddy Daniel was already climbing V14. So I was like, oh, I climbed V11. Now it's time for V12. It was just a natural progression. And they really were important in that. I just had those role models, even though they're my total peers. They're definitely people I look up to.
Dude, that sentiment is like so much more rare than it should be. I think like I grew up very, very similar in climbing and comp climbing, where, you know, I started relatively late compared to the local crew. Like, there was like Namirko Caballero, who was already climbing like V13, you know, at 13. And Ross and Sam were already sending double digit boulders. And I came in and I was like, but I want to be strong. I want to be just as good as them. And I never was going to be. Like, I think I knew that right away. Like, physically, I knew I was never going to be. They were like bred for the sport.
I don't know.
Or at least, maybe at the age or at the,
But like, at 12. I don't care about the result, right? Exactly. At that age, I knew I was never going to be. So what that approach changed, right? So yeah, my point here is that you decide to go sport climbing, right? You decide, well, but something comes more naturally to me. And I think like that sentiment is extremely rare, where kids, you know, are like, obviously kids are competitive and obviously kids like want to be better than the next guy. And that, I think, you know, when you grow mature in like perspective, you're like, well, but that osmosis that you're saying, that's what's really helpful, is just observing. And I think as kids, we have a little bit different emotion behind it, but objectively, that's probably the best way to grow, is to be like, okay, well, what is this person doing that I am not doing? And what is the success and failure? What are the pros and cons? Because it's not to say that like every climber you ever watch is going to be just perfect, right? And in fact, nobody is. So when you watch, also be good at observing what's good for me and what's not good for me. And I think like that works out really well, more so than most kids put credit into, but then also deviating to what you actually are good at and what you actually enjoy and leaning that way. And then also not being discouraged. I think, you know, Josh's point, not being discouraged, is, I think that's really, really, also rare, you know, because kids get like competitive and then discouraged because they feel kind of emotionally attacked by this person's better than me. I must not be right here. And it's like, oh, it's not about that. It's like they're doing some things better and they understand some things right at that time. And like, that's to me the coolest part about climbing. So it's cool to hear your whole upcoming with it and, you know, involved with some of the greatest of all times. And then it's the same sentiment that I think a lot of kids can have, but you had to have that objective layer, that objective lens to be able to be like, well, but this is just good. This is bad. I'm going to go this way. And I think that's the rare part. That's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, I guess there definitely was times where I was discouraged a bit, you know, because no matter how hard I worked we would meet up in Waco for, it wasn't all just like, oh, I'll just work harder. But, you know, there were those points I would work harder. Like we'd go to the Rocky Mountain National Park in the summer. We'd all meet up. Everyone would do their thing. We would, most of us, all of us probably walked away from those trips like super motivated. Oh yeah, like next big trip will probably be Waco for winter break or something like that. And then there would be a point where like work so hard and then go to Waco and meet up with Daniel and them, and you have Daniel, you know, climb his Crown of Aragon in 5 minutes, and I'm like, I can't actually do the crux move of this or whatever at the time, you know. It's just so crazy, like how, like Daniel, his lineage of progression was incredible. Like one season we went to Waco, I think it was like 2003, and it was one of our first, it probably was our first trip together and his first time in Waco. We went to Jablonk, I remember, and maybe we did choir boys or something like that, and Daniel like couldn't really do the moves on Jablonk, and then the next day he did it easily and then was like, I'll come back in a couple months, you know, and be stronger. And I think he came back in a couple months and climbed Esperanza. You know, like the jump was like substantial, like insanely. It wasn't like he came back next month and did, you know, Wright Martini or something. He just went all the way to the top. And at the time, that was probably the hardest boulder problem in Waco, if not one of the hardest boulder problems in the country. So it was just like that. Like he did Etchalay, I think, and then went and did Esperanza. And, you know, maybe it was the season before when he worked on Chablanc, you know?
Well, what's interesting is I wonder, he said that he hasn't really gotten that much stronger, you know, since then. Like, I wonder if he really hit his strength peak, because, you know, you kind of, there is a bit of a ceiling where it's like, okay, you can go train a ton more and you get 0.5% stronger, you know? And I just wonder if he hit his physical strength and he's gotten to be a better climber. But on this idea of Daniel, it sounded like he was the one who was still kind of pushing sport climber. He was interested in sport climbing, but what I find really,
he definitely was.
Yeah. Which is cool that, he does it all, but what's interesting is when I think about, we've talked a little bit about this in our like pre-interview, you and Daniel actually are somewhat, similarly shaped. Like, you know, you guys are, I don't know, very muscular, so similar heights, probably somewhat similar wingspan. But when I think of Daniel climbing, and maybe this is why he excels in bouldering, he almost seems to, I don't want to say this is bad technique, but I'm going to just use the word overpower things. Like I kind of think of him as being this ball of tension. And, you know, how did you see that translate into his sport climb or not translate? And how do you think about your style of climbing compared to his, where clearly you guys climbed on boulders side by side, but you really excel in the sport climbing arena?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually kind of cool because recently I've been learning a lot about physiology, just different ways that athletes exhibit their strength or utilize their strength. And what I think Daniel is like a classic example of someone with like an extremely high volume of like anaerobic power. Like, so he can pull on a crimp as hard as he can for longer than most of us can. It doesn't necessarily mean that he can crimp harder than us, but he can just do it more for longer, you know? He's so strong, like, and he's been able to be strong like that for over a decade. You know what I mean? So I don't think he's actually even gotten that much stronger. He's just building on that anaerobic base, basically. And so when he goes sport climbing, it takes him a little bit of time to adapt and maybe get a little bit of aerobic, you know, endurance and stuff. And, but he's just so much stronger that the moves simply, he's able to sustain harder moves for longer. And that's what creates a really good sport climber in Daniel. But he might have this like period of time where he just like pumps out in total elbows to the wall, like really pumped. But then the next week you'll see him completely different. All of a sudden, like instantly a sport climber. It's because he has this solid base of pure power. And I think the difference between him and me is that I had a pretty solid anaerobic base, but I was probably more aerobically gifted. Like, so I was able to like do the marathon type routes when I was really young and just hang on forever and just be on the wall longer than, let's say, like it probably switches into aerobic, like your muscles and the way you release like energy is like changes after a couple minutes. So like past a boulder problem, right? And then all of a sudden you're an endurance athlete in a way. So
yeah,
if you're on the wall for half an hour, that's an endurance performance, but under 5 minutes or under three or two minutes, even that's anaerobic maximum power. And that's what Daniel's extremely good at.
I was talking to Josh about Cam Hurst, who has a coaching website, who blogs on his coaching website about his sends, and he talked about that. He talked
that
about
exact the thing,
that exact thing, and he explained it a little bit differently than you, but it's the same exact idea where you know some things are spent first and then some things come later. So how you train is like very specific, and I think that thing you're talking about people having an extremely large anaerobic base and that's what they base their, you know, hard climbing off of or their output off of. I think that's a lot of American climbers are like that, which is to kind of go back to Josh's question earlier about like I think you know why American sport climbing maybe like I think it's just the approach in training. I think it's just the approach and the sheer volume, the sheer capacity of athletes that exist. I mean,
so it's funny, like speaking of like our volume of high end sport climbers versus Europe or something like that, you know, how it's like relatively low probably. But I think we're sitting on a gold mine of like hundreds of extremely good American sport climbers, but they all just choose the boulder right now. But the moment they decide to get their act together and do a little bit of endurance training and apply this probably massive anaerobic base that most of these boulders have, they're going to all climb 515s or, you know what I mean? Not 515s, but they're all going to like extremely excel at endurance climbing.
Yeah. And I thought you were going to say too, not to do like, it. American boulder, there's a million American boulders. Like I see kids every day who can send like harder than I've ever seen send, you know, and maybe performance is a different mindset here, which is something that we, you know, we talk about a lot, but in terms of sheer ability and sheer potential, American boulders are absolutely ridiculous. Like the kids nowadays are crazy.
Yeah. Like just moving back to New Mexico and Albuquerque, a couple of the guys that work at the gym, a couple of the kids, they're like between 19 and 21 or 22. One of them just climbed their first V14 this year. He's so strong, like he's incredibly strong, but they're completely like deer in the headlights, like intimidated from like 14A, and like 14A is so far below your anaerobic base, like it's crazy. But they just don't know how to operate necessarily, and the number itself and like all these external factors kind of prevent them from like pursuing, and like 14B is like the ceiling of the earth for them. They don't even like, you know, they're like, I will never go past that. I'm like, you could easily climb 14D if you just had one to go try and weren't as intimidated by it.
The only thing about that that's interesting though is sometimes you get these people who are freakishly strong and their technique is good. I mean, you can't say when someone climbs V14 that their technique isn't good. But it's not good in this way where it's like they're so powerful, they waste so much energy in the way they climb. And, you know, translating that over to climbing, I mean, I know someone who has climbed V13 and I'm not sure they can climb 5'11". Like if you took them to a crag, I'm not joking. Yeah. I'm like, if you took them to a crag and were just like, hey, like, let's go, you know, on site a bunch of 5'11s, they might be able on site like a 3-bolt 512 or something, but putting them on, you know, really understanding how to twist and everything, you know, it's just bouldering really is different. And I always tell people who start climbing, that they should do more sport climbing because of the sheer volume of movement you get and just drilling that kind of efficiency, because it, I think it does come through in hard bouldering too, because typically the most efficient way to do a move is actually the best way. It's not just efficient, it's actually the easiest way, even if you were at your max limit, which is hard for people to get sometimes, I think.
That's a hard thing to understand. And I feel like that, that's like, you know, it's so hard to understand because if you understood it as inefficiency, you would see it as like, you know, you're sprinting a long run, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, why are you sprinting a long run? Because it's in climbing, it's not that simple, but that's what I see. When I see people like strong boulders try to do a long route, I'm like, you're sprinting this run. Like, what are you doing? Like, why are you going all crazy?
That's totally how
it's kind of crazy to think of, like, if you compare climbing to other sports, if you look at like the marathon record, basically it's a long race. So it's a totally an endurance based race, right? So so the under 2 hours are reaching 2 hours, but the people running at that pace are running at sprint. So their maximum power output is close to a sprint. It's crazy how fast those runners run. Right. Like the amount of power needed.
Sport climbing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And but to go back to the original
I just wanted to, because you brought up Daniel and like anaerobic threshold, there's something really interesting about what you said, this idea that he has a really large anaerobic threshold. And there's kind of two ideas there. There's absolute power output, right? Like how much power can you do in 1 second? And then this idea of how can you sustain your near maximal anaerobic threshold, which I think is actually only like 40 seconds or a minute. And the idea that maybe he has like, you know, instead of it being 35 seconds where he can sustain nearly 100% power, it's like 52 seconds. And when you said that, it really made me think of how Daniel often climbs boulders where it's like, whenever I watch him climb boulders, it's like he overemphasizes getting into a position. Like he locks it off for longer to really find that next hold. And it's almost like you're like, dude, you are climbing like a sloth sport climber, except for you're on V15. And it's really interesting hearing you say that, because it kind of was like, oh, like maybe he's almost like a slow boulderer because he has a lot of power resistance.
He has so much power.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. That's just kind of an interesting idea.
Yeah, I would love the lattice guys or someone to do those tests on him, because I think he would match up really close to the test that they did on like Will Bosey and Stefano. Of course, Daniel, we're talking about one of the best boulders ever. So there's no doubt that his max power is there. But I would be, you know, I would think that his actual like the threshold, his endurance is better than most people would think, just
in that anaerobic
way he climbs. Yeah.
Yeah. It's so interesting.
And like how you're explaining, he really does like stay in positions probably longer than a climber, like, I don't know, like Dave, maybe, you know, like Daniel stays in harder positions and Dave gets out of them really quick. He's a really smart climber and he climbs completely different, but their outputs are probably very different, you know?
And I watched you climb a bunch on video before we did this chat, and watching you on like La Rambla, like I don't think of you as being a super dynamic climber where you're all about jumping and cutting. But when you were on, you know, on sport climbs, you're really like moving through, you know, you're not that, you're not super locking off every move, you know, and it's just interesting seeing that style come through better in sport climbing. And I wonder if that's why, you know, you gravitated towards, because just you're, when you tap into how you want to move, because I don't think that Daniel was like, oh, you know what, I'm going to choose to do it this style. It's just like, that's how it came out of him and that's who he is.
Yeah.
And I love that, you know, when you express yourself on these amazing climbs, like that's how you show up, is just this smooth, flowy, like consistent, and it looks way different. You know, it looks way different.
Yeah. I've been told that a lot, and I've thought about this a lot before this conversation. And I think what's really brought me into sport climbing is I find that it's quite a bit more cerebral. Like it's very challenging for your mind. Like you're thinking a lot when you're sport climbing, and not that you're not thinking when you're bouldering, but bouldering is almost like a rehearsed thing. So you work a couple moves, and usually when you're doing those max limit moves, you're not thinking too much. You're just doing them, you know, whereas sport climbing, especially like on-site sport climbing, you have to think really critical thinking is like maximum. And it would be cool if we could someday like do a study of like how your brain is firing when you're doing like a really hard sport climb versus a short boulder prone that you've practiced. Say you practice a boulder prone for 3 days and they're like, all right, we're going to run the test now. And you get 10 minutes to try the boulder prone. And then the same with a sport climb. And then you get 20 minutes to redpoint the sport climb. I would be interested how much brain activity is going on for
also
each.
Like and on-site of course, versus redpoint. That would be cool. Like what's your brain look like on on-site? Cause it's, boy, is it different. Yeah. I'd like to say.
Yeah. And on-site is
thinking, but I don't know if I am.
I mean, on-site's probably my favorite type of climbing, I would say. And I've done a lot of it and I haven't really excelled like beyond 14A, but I've climbed a lot of 514 on-site. And it's really kind of the moments where I felt like the most capable and the most like alive in my climbing. Mostly because I feel like I'm physically tired, but I'm like, I come down from a hard onset and I feel very satisfied and kind of exhausted from it because my critical thinking and my, how much I processed what was going on was just like at another level than a hard red point. And almost a hard red point, I kind of shut off and try to like to go on autopilot a bit. We can say autopilot or in the zone or whatever. But with on-site, you can't really go too much into autopilot because you really have to think about what's happening next, move for move, that, you know?
I think that's coaching youth climbers in competitions, whether it's bouldering or sport climbing, actually, has become really interesting because of that. I've noticed that the ability to on-site for younger climbers nowadays is kind of very, very far from their ability to perform hard movements, hard committing movements on like volume slabs, paddle dynos, coordination movements, just straight up hard movements. But then there's always, I think competition setting is also getting a lot better in that you can have an extremely simple climb, a short climb, and have it be really involved and like require critical thinking to do well. And you know, having, and I think you like on-siting because you're really good at this. But a lot of kids really hate on-siting, like are really, really bad at it because their opinions, I think, you know, to on-site well and to have good critical thinking, you need to make decisions off of your opinions, right? You constantly have response from the climb. The climb says, all right, these are your holds. This is what's the best way to do it? That's based off an opinion. It's not necessarily based off of like pure logic. You're not like calculating it. You're like, well, based on all of the moves I've ever done, I think this is the best way to do it. And your base opinion is probably pretty accurate to the potential, the actual, right? And a lot of kids' base opinions are pretty damn far from like what they're actually capable of. And it's kind of about like meshing those two things together, right? And I think that's been like really interesting for me to coach for climbers because, yeah, most people have like really negative language when it comes to like, well, I just don't think I can do that. Or like, I probably can't do that. And like people lean towards that. Whereas for you, I think the objective focus is probably a lot more like, how do I do that, right? Like based on what I have, how do I do that? Right. And then you operate on it and it's painful. It's hard. It's, you know, it's pumpy, like, but you still operate on it.
It was often the case when I was younger, like, you know, there would be an onsite round for final. I would kind of prefer to be by myself observing the route.
Same here.
And I wanted that pure onsite cause I felt like I performed better. And so, you know, a lot of kids are relieved when it's like a flash format. They're like, oh, that's great. And I'm kind of like, I don't want to watch anyone climb the route. Yeah. I want to just go uninhibited in a way and just work with my intuition in the way that I think. Right. But as you sound pretty similar. We're probably, you know, the minority in that group, you know, probably most people would prefer to watch others climb first.
Right.
Yeah. Can I ask you? Or actually, I mean, I could ask both of you guys. You know, John, you talked about some of the mental side or the critical thinking in sport climbing versus bouldering. So I'm better at bouldering than I am at sport climbing, but I think I like it more. But where I struggle with sport climbing, and what I'd be curious to hear from you is I have a lot of self-talk where I feel like there's this emotional battle. Well, even at the like start, I'm like, oh, I'm tying in. I'm about to go like battle for like 20 minutes. Jesus. Yeah. And then I get to rest and I'm like looking up. I'm like, but I'm tired right now, you know? And and then there's all these moves. Like every time I do a move and I get really pumped, I'm like, I mean, Josh, you're like really pumped. Maybe like you're just like, you can't do this next move. You're tired now. And I mean, look, I'm an experienced sport climber. It's not like I haven't done it. I'm just being honest about, you know, it's like a battle for me where I would argue that I still win that battle. I'm like, no, just focus on the technique. You know where to put your foot there. Okay, now do the next one. But, you know, do you get that self-talk? Like, let's say you're on an on-site or a hard red point and you're at like a rest, you have that like running monologue that you have to battle, or is that just shows you what an amateur I am?
Well, I don't think that's amateur. I actually think that's a very common, that's like for most climbers, actually, even the like anyone at any level in a sport. And it could simply mean that, like, if we compare it to running, you're a sprinter and you just, that's what your body's designed for, what you've prepared for mentally and emotionally, or physically and mentally, right? So you are a sprinter, whereas some athletes are, you know, they run mid distance or long distance, and that's what they do, you know, and sure, you can cross train and, you know, some of the long distance or endurance climbers, let's bring it back to climbing, but the long, you know, the endurance climbers need a boulder in order to have more endurance, but vice versa, some of the boulders for max power, they need some endurance in order to sustain a competition round or to work on a project more than 20 minutes. Otherwise they'd never get projects done because they're just blown out after 20 minutes. But that inner monologue, I mean, that's a difficult thing to block. It definitely happens to me occasionally, usually when there's a little more pressure and it means more to me. But on a day-to-day basis, that really doesn't happen too much. It's mostly when there's more at stake, you know, like, oh, I really want to do the route this time, or I only have 5 days left in the trip, you know, so each attempt really, really matters. Now, I think the best way to kind of address that is just to focus on the climbing, like the actual physiology of the climbing. So like, if you're like, I don't know, I'm tired today, you know, just say like, well, maybe I'm at 60% today, so I'm going to give 100% of my 60% now, and however far up the route I can get. I just kind of think in numbers like that, or analytically a bit, of how I'm feeling, rather than putting negative self-talk in. I'll say like, dude, okay, if I'm more, yeah, you like that kind of thing.
Yeah, I love that answer. Yeah. First of all, I love that you said that. There almost is no, often there is no inner monologue for you. And I'm going to give my opinion on, I think, you know, why that happens. But I'm going to answer this. But then also you're saying that, you know, when it does happen, you just focus on the physiology of the climbing, which is exactly what you should focus on. And Josh, actually, that it almost reminded me exactly of one time, actually a couple of times. Josh is like a mentor of mine, you know, father figure of mine as well. He's older than me, and we obviously work together and, you know, have fun doing it, and we're great friends. But I have come to Josh, you know, for advice, and, you know, I've asked him, like, this is super hard, like, you know, does it get easier? Like, life is hard. Sometimes I'm like really busy, yeah, just jam-packed with stuff, super stressed out, like, you know, sometimes just get really frustrated, and I'm like, you know, how do you deal with that? He's like, you know what, Tim, it never gets easier, you get better. And I doubt Josh thinks that as often as I do about like how hard my day is or like how frustrating it is or whatever. He's usually focused on getting the day done because he has to. And I think that's exactly climbing. That's exactly sport climbing, where like, and for me, actually, something that that came to mind was, I also have a similar sentiment to John, where like, if I'm not sport climbing though, that inner monologue comes more often. And I took that approach to highballing. So when I went highballing, I would never, ever, ever, ever go for a big highball if I didn't have a significant amount of volume. And for me, that significant number changes from trip to trip, but a significant amount of experience or volume on highballs, period. On I take pads off of easy boulders just to throw in the extra psychological factor. Do, you know, countless easy laps. I purposefully stay on down climbs for a really, really long time, you know, just to like feel where I am and have that awareness. Not so that I like get better at having a response with my inner monologue, but just so that inner monologue doesn't come, right? Because when when you're aware of it and you realize, okay, this doesn't actually have an effect on my decision making, then you just kind of like let it be there. And I think that's really the rational thinking there. It's like, it doesn't have an effect. Like, it doesn't have a positive effect at all on what I'm trying to do. Yeah. And what I'm trying to do is nowhere even near what my inner monologue generally takes me. My inner monologue gives me my frustrations, my worries, my emotional response. So I, again, going back to your answer, I really like that. You said, I don't think I usually have an inner monologue. I'm like, because you probably sport climb a ton, like a ton, where you're often faced with that. And you're like, what doesn't, it's not going to get me to stick the next move. It's not going to get me to commit to this foothold. It's not going to get me to be efficient. You know?
I mean, and like we were saying before, I mean, the inner monologue does enter my mind, but then if it does, I rationalize it with X, Y, and Z, you know?
Yeah.
So if it's third day on, then I say it's third day on, you probably have 70% max output today. So why not capitalize with the 70% that you have? Don't expect 100 necessarily. It's like basic finance, probably, you know, it's like if you have X amount of money, instead of worrying about having way more money, maybe see what you can do with the money that you have, right? And then, you know, your output will be better. You know, you'll have more results out of that way of thinking, in my opinion.
Well, that's really cool to hear. And it makes me, I don't know if it makes me feel better that sometimes you both have the inner monologue, but it does make me feel, it's reassuring to me to hear that my approach of focusing on the climbing and something that I heard from you, John, is just this positive attitude, really. And this is something that Tim is always saying, is have a positive attitude. Like, I don't know, if you show up and you just don't feel good that day, you know, I hate those people who say, oh, conditions are bad. Like, oh, it's greasy a day, I'm not going to send. And you're just like, well, yeah, you're definitely not with that attitude. You know, why give up before you're even there? You don't know what you're capable of.
I say, like, you know, like if it's kind of humid or rainy, or like the wind doesn't come that day, or it's a little hotter, I always like kind of make a joke, like say I'm trying like an 8C plus or 14C, and I'm like, well, it's probably going to feel like 14D today. So today I'm trying 14D and not the 14C.
Your expectations.
It's good
can easily climb 14D. So,
well, it's not even that it's easy. It's just, I know that it's going to feel harder than what it did maybe the other day, you know, and that's a easier way to analyze conditions, I guess, or something like that, or fatigue or whatever.
These are,
it's kind of playing little tricks on you.
I love hearing these kind of little, it's almost like a little game you play. I am more of a boulder, and I'd say I'm more of a sprinter, to be honest, but I love the sport climbing because I actually love the battle that I have with my emotions and mental. I actually think it's really fun and really interesting. It's become really rewarding. And so on this note of on-siting, flashing, you guys don't love flashing, reminded me of...
not as much, yeah.
Well, it reminded me of another question from our good friend Ethan Pringle, who...
Oh, great. friend, I guess, between all of us. Ethan and I go back quite a long time.
He gets around, man. Everywhere. He's been doing it for a while.
Let's go to his question, but did he tell you like our first trip in France in 2006 or 2007? And we road tripped and we're hitchhiking. It's when he did biography and we were just like dirt bagging to the max. Kind of.
No, but please go on. Maybe that would explain one of his other questions around shaved heads.
Okay, well, we could start with his question.
It looks like this actually takes us to France as well. I don't even know how to pronounce this Craig's name, but is it Saint-Léger? Is that?
Yes, Saint-Léger.
Saint-Léger. Looks like you have climbed there a bit in the not too recent past. And Ethan was just kind of wondering about your opinions on Super Krakenet and really like what you thought of the climb and Andra flashing it. And, you know, is it really super hard? And it looks like you put some effort into that climb too. And yeah, just insight into that process.
Okay. That's a great question because it's the most fresh for me. So I put a lot of effort into Super Krakenet this spring. I think I tried it about 30 days or 25 days. So a significant amount of time for me, even that's just like a lot of days. And the most interesting thing that I learned about Super Krakenet is the style of climbing. This is basically the catalyst of what threw me down the rabbit hole of learning more about climbers' physiology, because I was really curious as to why I didn't climb the route. And because it on paper and the style moves and all that, it kind of looked like something that I could go and climb relatively easily. But then upon reflection, I realized that 99% of the routes, or the majority of the routes that I've climbed at or near that level, are three times as long and triple the amount of moves. And this didn't really register to me at the time. But to talk about Kraken Ed itself is, yes, it's really hard. It's basically 30 moves of V8 to V9 climbing. And there's no one specific move that's much harder, and there's no one specific move that's much easier. It's basically a sprint. But relatively speaking, the moves aren't very challenging. It's just every single move has a little bit to it. And there's no just shake out and chill spot at all. So it's a marathon. It's a half marathon, we'll say, or something like that. It's that mid distance, really hard power endurance climb. And I underestimated it completely. I thought that, like, because the moves weren't so hard and that I had a ton of endurance, that it would be relatively, like, not super difficult. Hard. I expected 515, but I expected something that would just kind of click really quick. In fact, it did the complete opposite. And it wasn't until after about 5 weeks of trying it that I had my best try. And it was like the last day that we left, I like stuck the crux and fell off. And it was kind of interesting. That's when I realized, like, my anaerobic base was way smaller than I thought it was. Basically, I would gas out at like 1 minute or less than 1 minute. And I needed 2 minutes to climb the route. So before the trip, I did a ton of endurance, power endurance. I did long circuits, and each, on average, on the circuits, I was probably on the wall longer than 3 minutes, and the moves were significantly easier. So I wasn't, for a route like that, you need your max power completely at its peak, and mine was down. I kind of did the opposite of training, where I trained power and a lot of physical work early on in my training cycle. And then I like meshed in a bunch of endurance a few weeks before the trip. And that was actually what probably killed my progress on the route. As if I were to flip it and start my training block with a ton of endurance climbing and then work in max power and physical training leading up to the trip, I probably would have climbed the Super Kraken Ed. What's that?
Just before you go, because I really want to, like, mm-hmm. highlight this or put a bookmark for maybe us to revisit later. But something you said, mm-hmm. Something you said right in the beginning was really important to me, where you struggled on a route that you thought you were going to do well on. And then what it made you do is dive into literature and understanding and that. Deconstructing the route. Mm-hmm. And we can, like, cause a topic that I want to, look at later is kind of like this busting plateaus, what happens mm-hmm. when you hit a plateau, especially at such a high level that you're at. And actually, Ethan had questions around, like, your structure of training, but I just wanted to bookmark that because that is so freaking cool that you did that and really interesting. But Almandra, is it as impressive a flash as, you know, the headlines made it out? Because it sure seemed impressive.
It's extremely impressive. It's beyond what the headlines say. And I know there's, you know, and to be totally honest, Super Kraken Ed is probably quite low end 9A+. And one could even argue that it could be a 9A, a 14+, but I don't think anyone's doing themselves any favor of calling that route 14D, to be honest. It's just like harder than any other 14D imaginable, basically. So theoretically, that makes it 9A+, but it's just barely, I would say, 9A+. Although, like, Adam or some of these World Cup climbers are probably the perfect examples of the type of climber that could flash a route like this, because it is so incredibly sustained and technical. There's small feet, there's small hands, there's no jugs, but there's no terrible hold on the route either. So it's basically like a World Cup final route. But a bit harder, you know what I mean? And
my first World Cup season, in I think 2000 and 2019 was I had the same sentiment, the same exact, or 2018. I think it was the same exact thing where I trained a ton of endurance, a ton of aerobic capacity. I was even running like a ton. I'd never run before for climbing. I was running a ton. I also gained 10 pounds running over 3 months.
Oh, you built your legs.
My legs.
Climbers
so
have
much.
To be very careful with running. I actually don't suggest it at all.
Same. Yeah. Same after that, especially I was like, a lot of the kids that I would coach would be like, should I start running? I'm like, nah, like probably not. It was definitely not helpful.
Maybe
for me.
For fun, you know, or active recovery. But.
Right. But finding some aerobic capacity training is definitely helpful. But yes. I did the exact same thing. I was doing, you know, 100 move circuits, 1,000 moves a day, like going crazy, like 2 weeks on, and then doing like straight into like more low intensity power endurance training. I was like, I'm the fittest I've ever been.
Mm-hmm.
And I showed up to the World Cups, and the average score to like make the semifinal was like about 30 holds. And like, that is exactly what I thought when I saw Super Cranking It. I was like, oh, well, I mean, Andre is the perfect climber to do that because for him, you know, V8 to V9, V10 movements don't feel that stressful. Like, it's not even that, like, of course, his physical capabilities are higher in order to send that route. Like you're saying, your anaerobic capacity was just straight up not there. And his is probably there, but it doesn't mean just to me that I know I'm sure there are people who have the base to be able to do that route and maybe still wouldn't, right? Or definitely wouldn't flash it. And for him, it was like the comfort thing. Like watching him climb it, I think the significant thing was how comfortable he looked, right?
It's insane. I mean, I saw two people climb it when we were there, actually. And one guy tried it like 1,000 times, kind of. So when he did it, it looked like cruise mode.
That's
easier
awesome.
Than Adam, for sure. But he had tried it, you know, 100 more times than Adam, obviously. But the other, you know, it's just the way you climb it is just so fast. You don't really see a lot of scrappy errors in it, you know, but people are still fighting. And with Adam, that video is just, it's really impressive. I mean, it's crazy. That route, or he was built for that route basically, I think. And he prepared for it accurately. And I think having that base of like the way the World Cup climbers train, you know, I think that was really helpful in that route.
Yeah.
And it's funny because like I was getting frustrated in France because I was in good shape. You know, I would, for one day I stepped away and I could do 8C plus in a couple tries. And I was like, I'm clearly in good shape, but this 8C plus was like 80 feet long, you know, and I was built for that. I should have gone to Spain, you know, or I should have gone to another crag and just try a longer hard route. And I probably would have climbed really well in like Oleana. But simply put, it's too late that in a performance phase like that, you can't just switch into that, building that anaerobic base. But ironically, what happened was climbing on that route kind of did train me. So by the end of the trip, I had my best tries and I was like, wow, I'm like going to send the route now. But then we had to go home. We already kind of like pushed it to the max, you know? And then when I came home to New Mexico, I was like in the best shape I had been in years. And I had nothing to climb on. We went down to the tunnel and I climbed a couple 14 minus routes. And, you know, it was always just like, wow, I can't believe I missed my peak that hardcore. And that's going to Josh's point. Like, that's what made me really think, like, I didn't just like miss the goal here. I like completely shot another target. Like, I didn't even like, and I wanted to learn why. And then actually, funny thing about Cameron Hurst is I saw his blog on why he was climbing those routes and that he's actually going to school for this. So let's keep in mind that I'm kind of armchair expert here. I'm just like looking at books and online articles. So I'm an expert by no means. I'm no expert on this. So I'm just learning about it. But I read his article and I was like, that's really interesting. That is completely not what I did for my training, what he explains in that. And I was like, that's probably why I felt really strong cracking that 6 weeks after into trying it. You know, I peaked when I got home. It was like, that was eye opening, but I, at the time I didn't know why. I just thought I was fit from the trip. And usually when I come back from trips, I'm like tired, you know what I mean? But this time I rested for a few days, relaxed a little bit. And then I was like peaking, you know, I was like, should I fly back to France like right now for a week and probably be perfect, you know? But, you know, I kind of wrote it off and I was like, I'm going to use this as like a kind of a big learning platform, you know, and it was kind of like a tail between my legs. Like, it's been a few years since I've climbed really a hard route like that. And mostly, I mean, I've talked to you guys a little bit about it, or brought it up, is like, because of the root, I had this epiphany of like the routes that I'm trying in the last couple of years, and the style of climbs are not only harder grade wise, but they're completely a different physiology chain or like a style than what I did in the past. You know, the last really hard route I did was Joe Mama, and it's, you know, 110 feet long. You know, it's a pure endurance climb. And that was like a peak. I was climbing really well at that time. So like the next projects, all of the other projects I've had since then are like half that length and much, much harder. So I wanted to learn how to better prepare for these routes. And then the Krakenet basically was right in my face, an example of what happened, you know, and how I could train better. So that's my mission now, is just preparing better for the fall projects that I have.
Oh, that's so cool. I just love that acknowledgement. That's awesome. Of, you know, there's something to be said for just climbing a bunch, building that base, like, you know, learning how to climb, and that will get you really far, just showing up and trying hard mm-hmm. day after day after day. But, you know, we kind of talked a little bit about, maybe we can go into, or you just kind of did, about this busting of plateaus. And, you know, no matter how good you are, you always, you know, there's times where it's tough to progress. And I just love that thinking where you look back on your career and where you've seen a lot of success and where you're struggling in, and, you know, just kind of picking at that and looking for threads that are the same or different, and then changing your training or potentially route choice to emphasize what you're good at. And, I find that just really interesting that, you know, you notice that those particular climbs kind of were this middle ground almost, where you're like, oh, like I actually have really, really good endurance on long stuff, and you're clearly a strong boulderer, but then there's this other kind of middle distance. I gotta say, Ethan, in that same question about Super Krakenet, he said, uh-huh. Will Andre flash Joe Mama, which is interesting.
Oh, well, funny story about the Joe Mama thing, and Krakenet, is Maddie Hong and I, we were in Spain with Adam when he was preparing to flash that route. And at the time he had already done Krakenet. But we were formulating a story for Real Rock, and they were kind of getting their pieces in line, and, or maybe, did he do it? I think he did it, or he was about to, maybe he did it just after that trip. Long story short, he didn't end up trying Joe Mama. But
that
we helped film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, and it was crazy.
Yeah. We shot that. So, we were there in that whole process of giving him the beta and him observing us climb and stuff,
that's right.
And his thought process behind that. And, unfortunately the weather didn't work out. It was kind of wet. Conditions weren't great. It was kind of tail end season of Oleana, and it was actually Maddie, or maybe it was both of us. We kind of advised him not to try it.
It sounded more like you two were the only ones in that whole thing, because everybody was like, this is the opportunity, like you got to go. And it mm-hmm. seemed like you guys were like, seemed kind of smart not to go. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, it's just clear that it wasn't a good season. Like it wasn't good.
Well, it was a good, like Matt, like people climbed hard that season, and Adam probably could have. There was a chance he would still flash the route, especially on the one day that it was kind of looking good. But I think, and it's not like I'm super close to Adam or Maddie is, but we're, you know, we know each other, and I think he saw me try it once or twice, and maybe some other people climbing on the wall, and just kind of like talking about the conditions a certain way. He was like looking at people's skin, like, what does your skin look like after the try? And I mean, he's really smart. I mean, and
dude, yeah.
And I think it was probably me and Maddie together. It was a couple of years ago now, so I don't remember exactly. But it was like, we were like, dude, I mean, you could probably make a really good try right now. But is it the best condition? Is it the day where it's like, you can't fall? You know, it's so sticky and it's like frictiony. That Oleana rock is really specific. It's really sharp. And if you get this cold, dry wind, it's like completely different texture. It's like the red or something, where one day to the next feels completely different. Same with Oleana. And on a peak performance attempt like flashing Joe Mama, kind of all the variables, even for someone like Adam, they need to be in the right place. So it just wasn't the season. But physically, could he flash? I think actually flashing a route like Joe Mama is probably an easier flash attempt than Super Krakenet, I would say. Wow. Just because there's more margin for, there's a larger margin for error on a route like that. And if he made it through the bottom and one or two moves in the upper crux, he would do it, I think, you know. And the fighting part where a lot of people fall off and where I fell a lot of times, where Maddie fell a few times and countless others who'd done the route, you know, I don't think he would fall in that section. Because I think, technically speaking, like, he's able to fight just that much more, you know? And we were too. It just took us longer to fight that much more, potentially, on routes that hard, you know? So that, long story short, the conditions just didn't line up, so he didn't try the route. And he still hasn't tried the route, as far as I know. So that's still there. And he hasn't tried Jumbo Love, and, you know.
Ooh, that'd be good. It does make sense. I like that you guys are probably the voice of reason in the sense that you understand how few 515s there really are. Like, if that is really his goal, like, you have to be strategic, because it's not like, I mean, because he's done so freaking many. You just, in the last, you know, hour have dropped the names of lots of very good climbers. Adam Hondra, Ethan Pringle, our mutual friend, and, you know, Daniel. And I guess I'm just kind of curious, being around all these guys, you know, what thread have you seen? Like, they're all so different. Like, all those climbers are really different. Like, they look different. They climb different. You know, Daniel to you know, Daniel and Almandra are very different kind of climbers. But, you know, we've talked about how the theme of this podcast is really how to go from good to great. And I want to hear about your journey from good to great, but maybe we can start by talking about some of these top climbers and what you see as a consistent thread, or what makes them different from everyone else, either what makes them all the same yet all, you know, unique and different.
I think what makes them all unique and different is exactly that they are all unique and different. Like, they, Adam, Daniel, and Ethan are the climbers we see today because they have pursued their own path. You know, they're not really followers at all. And if, you know, we've learned anything about excellence in sports or in business or beyond, is that there's individuals are really the people who succeed the most, you know, and that, or they innovators in a way. And I would say that, like, Daniel, for his time and age when we were young, is complete. He was an innovator in the way that he would train himself. You know, he was doing, like, one arm pull ups and, like you said, these tiny little dead hang things when he was really, really young. And no one taught him to do that. No coach said to do this. He kind of, I think maybe he knew of, like, James Litz and a couple other people who were just super strong and finger forward. And, like, and Daniel thought, like, that'll be me. I'm going to do that. You know, I'm going to be just wicked strong in my fingers and I'm going to be able to pull everything down to my chest. And where Ethan, I think Ethan and I kind of followed somewhat of a similar path, where we were inspired by generational type climbs, you know, like, very important test pieces through time, and kind of pursued that. And yeah, I think it's a natural progression that, like, when you pursue high end climbs like that, you break into a higher level of climbing. And then Adam, I think, you know, he's an innovator. We can't deny that. Like, he really is a game changer in the way that he viewed climbing training. Much like we could probably, and it will probably be said later in as time goes on, that Adam was probably very similar to Wolfgang Gulich in the sense that, like, what's Wolfgang famous for? Like, bringing new grades into the climbing world, but also the way he achieved them was different. He didn't just climb a new grade. He trained. He brought training to the, you know, he developed, like, training with the campus board and different types of physical training, right? From traditional sports, he brought it into climbing. And that's how he achieved probably those hard routes that he did in Germany and beyond. Same with Adam. We see him, you know, how many times have we all viewed, like, those videos where he kind of exposes his training style to people and everyone's blown away? There's memes about it. People are laughing, this and that, you know, like, with the miming or climbing in a sweat in a sauna, you know, to train for the Olympics. I mean, this stuff is kind of sounds silly, but you gotta admit that like that's different. The difference between him and everyone else is that he thought of it first, or maybe not first, but he applied it first and made it something. You know what I mean? So, much like business or something like that, that's why he's successful and that's why he's great, is because,
okay, you lagged out for a sec, but we'll edit there.
Oh, no worries.
Dude, I was definitely one of those people. I hate to say this because I freaking love watching Almendra now, but I was maybe put off at first by some of his techniques or tactics, and like that, the miming stuff where he would have people like pressing on his leg and really, doing it just like.
You were put off by the extreme training.
Yeah. Kinda. You know, I mean, just sometimes I would see him do things like the miming thing, especially. And I loved when he had his coach actually applying pressure to his knee and everything. And like, really, you could see that I feel like his visualization and mental obsession with that side of climbing really is unique and special. And it's something me and Tim talk a lot about, is how powerful visualization is. But it's one thing to talk about that. It's another to really make it important part of your training. And that's not to say that he slacks on any other area of his training, just that's cool. That's new or new ish.
And I think like more my point with the Adam, his greatness is more not that like whether it works or not, it's the fact that he's thinking of it that way. You know, where even I could tell you countless, or not countless, but a number of even pro climbers that actually follow a program that someone else did or that they just kind of create this formula that works for them. And year after year, it's kind of the same and they're not changing. But I would argue to say that like guys like Adam probably change the training all the time and are constantly looking for different loopholes and leaks and weaknesses and ways to improve. I mean, just constantly building on what he has already.
That what you're saying right now is like why coaching for me is equally like something I'm obsessed with, but also like constantly frustrated with constantly, because you know, my goal isn't to be a coach. My goal is to help people pursue excellence, pursue performance at their highest level, to achieve greatness in whatever they, you know, define. And a lot of people define greatness in the same way in climbing. You know, a lot of people see what greatness looks like and can somehow fathom, almost in our conversations right now, people can fathom that type of stuff, but somehow cannot translate that to their daily lives, right? So a lot of what insight that I provide is exactly what you're saying. Like, ask why it's even challenging, what you're doing. Ask yourself what the goal is, ask yourself what's challenging, and then ask yourself the value in like specific types of training. And then at the end of it, I always get asked for a training plan. And I'm like, listen though, like that's the point though, is like you have to find your own training plan, because you have to understand your value systems based on what you find challenging, based on what you have experienced, right? And everybody's going to experience something different. Now, a lot of us can come to the same conclusions about the importance of some physiology in our training. And that's where I think like people can go into the same net. So if I form training plans for people, I say, all right, well, this is the net of thought that we should be training our bodies in. But when it comes to the specifics, like the actual things that you're doing, that is totally dependent on your leaks and your weaknesses and your lowest hanging fruits and what you value.
Right. Yeah. And that's kind of been my change of thought. My rethinking of training this year has been, don't necessarily change the training, but understand how I'm training. You know what I mean? So I think more valuable to anyone is just to understand what's happening when you go in and do a fingerboard exercise, or you do a power exercise, or you do, you know, endurance on a rope. Just understand what that is. And you can interchange the exercises in an infinite possible way, you know, like different ways, you know, but if you understand that what you're actually doing and how that translates into your training or your body, that's probably more important than the actual exercise.
Right. And I will say, you know, to the listeners out there, I think there's nothing wrong with following any sort of monotonous routine, because that will build something, right?
Yeah.
That will build something. Absolutely.
Yeah. Right. That's a great disclaimer.
Right. But that's like people end up making that the end all be all, where it's like, what's my next progression? You know?
Well, I just want to point out though, that just to combine what you guys are both saying, is that if you can go out and follow a monotonous program and you will learn something, but, or you will probably maybe even progress, but it's what you're doing, John, where it's more about learning something. So you followed some program mm-hmm. that didn't really accomplish what you were looking to accomplish with CrackNet. You trained, you got stronger. You just maybe got stronger mm-hmm. in a way that wasn't advantageous for your goals. And so to me, it's like, that's the combining of all those factors. It's like, okay, like hangboarding can get my fingers stronger. Okay, this, aerobic training can do this, but bring it all together and apply, or maybe it's applying that. And then the next step is bringing that all together and say like, what am I doing? Why am I doing it? What was the outcome?
Yeah.
How can I tweak this for next time?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
And you almost have to have like a backwards approach where you understand the goal deeply and understand exactly how to get to that goal, or you have to fail enough times with that goal and then dissect it.
Yeah. And I never meant to like discredit like coaching or anything. Like, I think it's really an important part of climbing, and a lot of athletes and young climbers especially, they need that structure. It's very important. And in the first few years of climbing, you learn kind of the base general skills, but then a little bit of structured training is very important. And even without a huge understanding of why you're doing it, just if the coach says and follow the program, you should improve, but I think when you get to the point that the Adams and the Daniels and Ethans and myself are, it's like you really need to understand what each kind of part of training or bit of climbing you're doing is actually doing to your body, and then there's the kind of an older school style of climbing. Like, so this is interesting. Like, we could talk about Dave and Chris and that generation a bit, where they don't train necessarily. Chris might, do a little bit of time in the gyms because he's in the city a lot. He has a family, owns gyms. He climbs in the gym a bit. But Dave definitely doesn't, and Dave has had like small stints of a little bit of training, but very unstructured and kind of just climbing. And I think these guys are training without realizing it though, because of Dave is doing 5 days a week on 8C Boulder, climbing for 4 hours at a time. That's significant training already. It just doesn't look like what it does in the gym necessarily. Or if Chris is trying, his project Sleeping Lion that he climbed, if he's trying that 2 times a week, that's significant training as well. It just, the timeline for those, the results from that might just be a little bit longer, but I actually, it's funny, I listened to an interview with Chris recently, because I really like Chris's like outlook on climbing and his philosophy around it. And he said, it was so awesome. And it applies a lot to what we're talking about now, was that like, okay, you could look at two climbers climbing biography, used biography as just a general example. And you have climber A, who, goes there 3 years in a row, like a lot of climbers have or whatever, and just try it. And, just beat it into submission and work through it and then send it eventually, after this long process. And then you have climber B, who goes to Seyus and climbs it in 2 weeks or in a few short sessions or something like that. But what led up to that ascent was probably months or if not years of training and specifically preparing for that climb. So on paper, one guy does it in this amount of time and then the other climber does it in this amount of time. That's a bit longer, but it's probably close to even actually the amount of effort it took to climb the route in terms of, you just talk about back end work or front end work. So back end work, putting time in the gym, working really hard for a specific goal, that's months. So it's kind of funny, like I went to CrackNet and tried it for 5 weeks and say I sent it. So I say I sent it in 5 weeks and, 30 days and, 60 tries. However, it's hard to argue that my effort didn't start months before when I started training for the route, so. There's two ways to view success in climbs. So like when Dave sends a route, a boulder prom, it takes him 50 days and he does a new V16, and then Daniel goes and climbs it in 15 days. But Daniel probably spent a lot of the season already training in the gym, sacrificing those days on rock to train. So their output, their amount of effort is roughly the same or similar. And so that's Chris's nugget or whatever, his knowledge, his wise perspective.
Yeah, I've been experiencing something in my climbing, like, quite similar. I mean, Josh and I've talked about this. Like, I have personally never climbed anything harder than V14. I've actually only done one. Personally, I believe I've done much harder than that in the gym, and I've only done, like, you know, and I constantly climb in the gym. Josh and I are, like, obsessed with the gym. You know, we're obsessed with the gym culture and, like, what the gym can provide. And also, I think that, you know, experience, but also we're obsessed with the outdoors. We're obsessed with going out and, like, trying climbs. And, like, actually, Josh has told me multiple times that he's, like, never really projected anything. I'm like, yeah, there's nothing, like, but you can send hard. Like, you could send super hard. And I think that's definitely interesting. I've thought about that a lot. And a lot of people have asked me what's better. And my answer is always do both. My answer is always do both, because it's not so much of what amounts to more success. It's just your perspectives are going to change. You know, like if you experience one side of climbing where, you know, you do a bunch of training and you go out and send, which is my approach to climbing, where, you know, I did a day in Mohs where I did like 10 double digits. I did three V13s and I flashed my first V12. And it's like, but I did all of that training for many, many, many years. And I showed up one day, I happened to have a new crag with a bunch of climbs that I could do at first try. And people are like, that's insane. I'm like, yeah, but I do that like daily.
I'm kind prepared of, you know, for like, that.
I prepare for that daily, you know, but then also now I'm kind of sick of it. I'm kind of sick of the perspective. I want to go and try something and, you know, bang my head on it for thousands of tries, you know, and
I mean,
something
impossible. You probably owe it to yourself. Like, you know, maybe don't train as hard one season, but train a little bit and then go to a place with the intention of just laying down camp and working really hard. In the end, the amount of time, the timeline might be similar, you know, to the success, but potentially projecting like what Chris and Dave and a lot of people do and myself, you know, could yield higher results a bit, you know, if you've never done it before, especially.
What I hear from that is that the number one thing that is required is always effort, right? Like, you know, high output of effort, where it's like, okay, maybe Chris just lives at the crag, or, you know, Dave puts in, you know, 50 days and he's out there trying hard. I think what it means is that it's hard to put out effort on something when you don't like it. So, you know, if you're not psyched on the gym, like maybe, you know, Dave just, I don't know, I don't see him as like being a gym rat and just, he's probably not having a blast there. Like where he finds his ability to really put it out is on the rug. And then for me, I do enjoy the gym. I also, you know, I was living in San Francisco. There wasn't much rock around me, you know, and you got a job and you just do what you do, you know? But
and you have wonder, you have amazing gyms. Yeah.
Yeah. God, those gyms were amazing. But you know, to me, what I hear from that is showing up, doing what you love and putting it all out there really does lead to success. Although then it does seem like in some ways, as you start getting at that really high end though, that there's probably some tactics that you employ, or, you know, cause even with Chris and Dave, I have a hunch that I'm not saying like they're out there on the hangboard with some secret, program that's giving them all their results, but to think that over their, you know, multi-decade career that they don't have little things that they do that kind of helps them show up better in those moments prepared seems naive to me, even if it may not look like quote unquote, you know, they're not like, oh, look, I have these no hang blocks that I do with my back three and it really makes a difference. It's not that, right? It's like,
It's something
unique to them.
But I think, you know, when we view climbers like Dave and Chris and a handful of others, I mean, their generation of climbers started in a completely different era of, you know, not totally different than us, because maybe me and you, Josh, were kind of similar, closer to them in age. But, you know, the climbing gyms, when they first started climbing, were not what they are today. The training culture, even with the Golics and stuff like that, still isn't what it is today. And so they've learned how to progress in climbing in a very unique way through rock climbing, basically. And their skills on the rock are obviously incredible. And then now we have the generation where people's skill on rock probably isn't quite as good, but they're just so much stronger. I mean, they're 10 times stronger than not than those guys, but then maybe than those guys at that same age. You know what I mean? Like they're so strong. It's incredible.
it really makes me think of, it makes me think of two things. I've got a few years on you, and I think I started a few years earlier. And so I was like back in like 94 or something is when I started. I want to say 94.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. And more like that, Dave's generation. Yeah.
Yeah. Although right when I started kind of getting better, it's really like Chris was like the man. It was just like very clear, very early on that he was
the man boy.
Yeah.
He was like a kid probably. Yeah. Yeah.
But the reason why I bring it up is because I would say that back then training was taboo. Training would be embarrassing. It would be like the two things I remember would be like, don't train, or that would be, that would be like what you need to train. It really stood out in my head as like, that was not an appropriate thing to do back then. It was looked down upon for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. I don't want to get into it. But what also made me think of this ability on the rock. So I actually did know Ethan way, way back then, but I kind of reconnected with him later on in life. And I remember watching him on site, this 13C, as like a warm up when we were in China. And what really stood out in my head was the way he read the rock. It just showed me like the depth of knowledge he had of climbing on rock and understanding rock. And I just remember it cause it was like I sent it, but it was a very hard climb for me at the time. And the crux was cryptic. And it was like, you had to reach way back. It was completely blind. I had no idea how someone could figure it out. And Ethan climbed it perfectly. It's this thing where it's like, there's getting strong, there's climbing well, there's reading a route, I do think that in today's generation with climbing gyms and the training that we have available, we are creating people who are stronger but less technically proficient at rock climbing. And I have a hunch though that maybe we're starting to see this break out into another level. I do think that, maybe like the Sean Rabbit, the kind of a little bit even younger, more like in your age, Tim, where there's this combining
Aiden Roberts and
the best training and the best technical ability on rock. And it's cool to see climbing just continue to evolve.
Yeah. I think we're seeing like a big shift now where a lot of the skill-based climbers are being combined with a strong training background. So like Adam Andra is probably the first big example of that he has more years of climbing than so many people his age, right? He's been climbing almost his whole life. Then he added the training to it, like at an early age, and now all the younger climbers and Adam are coming up. They're so good because they're combining the two even more. And I'd say like in our, the Daniels and I, we were like, climb a lot and get strong, but now it's like get strong first, then go climb a lot, basically. And it's just a couple more years. We'll see how many B16 boulders, they're popping up everywhere, basically.
You guys, we should kind of start wrapping up. I have like a million questions and I don't know how to like,
I could talk a lot about this stuff. I find it like so interesting.
Oh, yeah. Oh, you too? Yeah. Really? You like this stuff too, Jeff?
Well, like actually breaking it down, cause I don't actually do it very often. And every now and then it's funny, like with the Ethan or some other friends, we actually do occasionally talk about stuff like that. Cause it's just cool.
Let's hear you and Ethan dirt bagging as kids and how fun it is. Oh. I think that's maybe that's a good transition to like being a pro, coming up and climbing, doing dirt bag stuff, but then being a pro. And what was that formative trip like with Ethan? When was that? How old were you guys?
So that was 2007, I believe, because I had just graduated high school the year before, or like right around there. So Ethan, how old is he? Ethan must be 2 or 3 years older than me.
He's about
3 years,
30, maybe 37, 36, 37.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. I'm 34. So we were young and it was, I had like a Razer flip phone and it didn't work in Europe, of course, like no contact, and no email. Like you go to internet cafes for like the email, once a month to the parents or whatever, or something like that. And we went there. I actually went earlier with a friend of mine, Gabor Sike. And I don't know if you guys have heard of Gabor. He's a climber from the Northeast growing up. He's a good friend of mine as well. He lives in Boulder now. He went into economics or something big, finance. But anyways, I was there with him and his family, and we were climbing in Nice and Gorsheloup. And I had known Ethan obviously from before, and he wanted to join our trip. So he flew down into Nice, and then we all went to Seyus for the summer. And then Gabor and his sister, they ended up, you know, leaving the trip. And then it was just Ethan and I, and then Matt Siegel joined us actually. And us three climbed like the whole summer. We stayed in one, like we were camping at first, and then some in Seyus, the campground, there's like these kind of like really old, kind of like broken down, like trailer homes. And the people staying in there, a little family, like moved out, and we jumped on the opportunity. So we all like took over one of this like trailer home thing. And it was kind of funny. Like, so we were all kind of in there, and we didn't really have a lot of money, even Ethan. And so we were kind of living off of like the cheap groceries that are there in the campground. So we're talking like a can of tuna, maybe some veggies, maybe, and then like a baguette, like every day, or tabbouleh, you know, like couscous and stuff. And we'd go into town, but the only way to get into town was to hitchhike. So down into Gap, which is about 45 minutes or half an hour drive down. Sometimes we'd stop in Sogoye on the way and get like little snacks, but it depended. Like, so sometimes the driver could only take us to Sogoye. So we'd stop in Sogoye, wait out for a while, and like literally like with a thumb out, you know, hitchhike, and then get into Gap. And then when we were in Gap, we'd splurge. We'd go get like some fruit. We'd get avocados, were huge. We ate like hundreds of avocados that summer, probably. Cause it was like high calorie. It lasted a long time. You didn't feel as hungry. And we would eat, we'd cook like simple pastas and rice and like that, and get our groceries for the day. And then once it was around like 3 or 4, it was kind of, you know, work was letting out. So a lot of people were driving out of the town. So we'd walk to this one road and just hitchhike and kind of wait until we could get rides back up to Seyus. So we did that all summer. And we had some friends, like once Ethan kind of hurt his finger really badly, like the skin, like tore his flapper off. And it was already like 2 months in Seyus. So we were both kind of burned out at the time. He was trying biography, getting really close. And then one day he decided to try some AB or whatever on another wall, and he broke a hold and like ripped his pad off the finger. And he was like, I'm over this. Let's leave Seyus. So we decided to, and I was kind of over it too. You know, 2 months of hiking up the hill, it's just like a lot of work. And so we were like, yeah, let's go. We have some time. So we like hitchhiked and got a ride from some friends that we knew in the campground to Innsbruck. And we stayed in Innsbruck for a couple of weeks and climbed in the gym, because I knew Jakob Schubert and a couple other friends at the time. So we stayed between their place and some others and just kind of hung out in Innsbruck and trained in the gym just so like the skin could heal. We climbed the Zillertal a little bit and bouldered around. And then we were like, well, it's time to go back to Seyus. And Ethan, I was like, yeah, you could definitely go do that route. So let's head back. And so we went back. We got a ride. I don't even Ethan remembers it better to me than me. It's kind of crazy. But I think we still got rides with friends, or maybe we took a train this time on the way back. We went back to France, and shortly after, Ethan climbed the route, and it was trip was done. And then it was funny because it was a thing like between Matt and Ethan and I. It's like the bet was like when he would send the route, we would shave our heads. So like he did the route, and we all had to shave our heads. It's kind of crazy.
Oh my God. Amazing.
It was like the ending. It was like this big release, you know, like he had this crazy mop of hair and I did too. And so did Matt. And we just all like shaved each other's heads. And that's the most that I remember from those trips. But it was all like completely different than the way we travel now and the way we view trips now. But it was super formative for me. And I met Dave that trip and climbed with Dave a bit. That's when he did biography as well. And that was like instrumental too, like seeing Dave and Ethan like travel the world and go climbing. And I was kind of doing the same, but I was kind of like hanging on a bit, not in their shadow necessarily, but you know, they're definitely like the ones, you know, the big pro climbers kind of doing the thing. And it kind of set that trend, you know, for a long time. That's kind of what I was kind of in a way tagging along with my friends, but my friends just happened to be like super high profile rock climbers, you know? So, That's how I got a lot of opportunity, but that's also maybe where a lot of what I did was shadowed a little bit, you know,
I remember,
based on just those I was around.
I kind of remember seeing either a video or hearing them talk about you being the most underrated climber, like that you were, that you were extremely strong and maybe a little under the radar, which is just funny to hear it from that perspective. But dude, how fun does that sound, man? Like, how, Tim, do you want to do that? I just want to do that. I'm like old with kids.
Well, it was
like,
really fun.
it's crazy because, like, I mean, I definitely experienced something similar. I definitely wasn't like, man, like my upcoming was, if I get strong enough and, you know, if I get to a place in social, you know, standpoint or whatever it is, I can get that opportunity. I can get that opportunity to go and do those things. But of course I was doing it. You know, I would go camping and like go on long road trips. I lived in Rifle in a tent for like 2 or 3 months in a row, like one time. And I was like, all right, that's it.
Good enough. Yeah.
That's it. But it's crazy because you don't almost I was like, I don't have to do this at all. Like I could find a way to like get somebody to like get stoked, get somebody to like, you know, rack up enough money to make it like a bougier trip, get, you know, some company to like support a video or like something. It feels like the industry is like completely different in that you guys had to do that to climb like hard routes almost, you know, like
especially back then that was kind of pretty normal.
So glamorous. Living on avocado actually does sound glamorous, but living on hardly anything like a can of tuna. And it's just funny because maybe we can use this to transition to a topic that we wanted to touch on. And it's just kind of like the behind the scenes of being a pro climber. Then as you get older and what that means, how do you transition into the next phase of your career, and how are we doing that with the existing climbers? And it was a different era. Although I will point out, Tim, that doing it in France probably sounds somehow more, or, you know, doing it in Europe sounds somehow more glamorous, but you're still just, I mean, anyone can go. It's just, I guess the thing I want to point out, cause we pointed this out with, God, I can't remember. Maybe it was with Carlo. Like a lot of people want to climb hard or say to themselves or say to their friends, and they're like, yeah, you know, if I was a pro and I could just, spend all day at the crag, I would send that too. And it's like, well, then just go fucking do it. Like, you guys weren't like, no one gave you permission and said like, hey, like, you know, you graduate high school and you're like, I scraped together a couple $100 and I'm good to go, you know? And so I just love that story. I love the passion there.
Yeah, I mean, there is something to say that like pro climbers or any pro athlete for that matter, basically the majority of the finance that goes into these athletes is exactly for that reason, to give them the time and the availability to go perform, right? But those finances aren't necessarily created or budgeted out to like give these people like long lasting careers with 401ks and retirements, and you know, it's just not the deal. And I think that's the big misconception with becoming a pro climber, is that like, yes, it is a career, I'll say that, like it sets a lot of individuals down the path of like being involved in the outdoor industry, and a lot of opportunities come up from being a high profile person, just period. I mean, your network and the amount of people and the visibility you get will lead to a lot of opportunity in the future. But the way these companies view it, or part of the way, is that they're supporting a product or a person to do a task. You know, most climbers are under, you know, independent contractors, and independent contractors are exactly what it sounds like. It's a contracted gig, not a salaried career necessarily, you know, and in the company's minds, it's kind of like, you know, just like you would when you're remodeling a house or something, you bring in subcontractors and contractors to do the work. But when the work's done, I mean, you don't need the contractors until you have the next line of work and coming in. I will say though, you know, in terms of longevity for a pro climber, it is in a company's best interest, most likely, to have a longer relationship with these independent contractors or their athlete team. It just looks better. They're able to develop on more product and have, or projects, not product, sometimes product, but on video projects, or they just see people grow. Like we've seen Chris grow through Piranha, right? You know, as a young kid and now as an adult, and potentially have invested in the company a bit. But, you know, those are the bigger examples of high profile athletes. But I think, you know, it should never really be the expectation that you'll become a pro climber and that this is like through the companies, that's going to be your lifelong career. Cause it's really just, they're giving you the opportunity to do your best as a professional figure in the sport, but not necessarily like a long lasting career with them, you know, but it goes both ways a bit, you know, if that makes any really sense. I don't know. I kind of went off a little. Yeah.
No, it's great because I think that's actually one of my questions for you was going to be, what is advice to kind of young climbers or people looking to go into this industry? And I think you said something really interesting there where they give you an opportunity. I'm going to paraphrase, but it's like you get an opportunity to start your professional career in a way. It wasn't just like that you sign up and it's like, hey, you're going to be on the dole for the rest of your life. Good luck. Or, you know, or have fun. Just go live it up. It's like, this is almost like a stepping stone to now you making almost like your own brand. And it's something me and Tim talk about. It's if you look at some of the most successful athletes, or even if you look at, you know, the roster of athletes in, I don't know, Black Diamond is you know, one of our favorite companies. And it's who Tim is sponsored by right now. And, you know, it's not that it's just the hardest climbers in the world, you know, and the people who've been on there and been part of the team for a long time, they add something as a professional to the climbing community that is not just sending hard. And so I just think there's something there that I love where it wasn't like, you know, this is the only path. Like you just need to send hard and you'll make money for the rest of your life. It's like, no, this is the start, you know?
Well, you know, some of the best advice I got when I was younger. So I'll start with that, you know, because I have my own advice for young climbers wanting to become professionals and pursue that. But Dave Graham, because he helped me a lot over the years of becoming a professional climber and getting me involved with certain companies. And his big thing was like, and maybe this is an East Coaster or Northeaster kind of thing, but he's like, people, they're just too self-entitled. They and this is like 15 years ago, right? So I don't want to just say, oh, Dave said this, Dave said that. But he was like, don't be so self-entitled. Like just because you climb so hard doesn't mean much as a professional climber. It really is like who you are in the community and how you interact with it. That's why we have influencers. That's why we have marketing campaigns. That's why we have top tier performance athletes, you know, people who go to World Cups or people who are doing just high end, you know, individual pursuits. But Dave really taught me that like being a pro climber, a professional climber, especially we're talking the early 2000s. So it was a little different, you know, this is pre social media and all that. So like the biggest impact you could have was one of a couple ways or all three or all of them was A, doing kind of cutting edge climbing that would get into a magazine at the time. Cause there was no, like, you know, there wasn't as much online presence, you know? So the magazine counted a lot and getting an article in the magazine was very big, but also becoming a presence in communities, you know, like if you go to Sayuse, people know Dave Graham, period. If you go anywhere into Chino, people know Dave Graham. If you go to Colorado, that's probably the most reach Dave has actually, because he's developed 90% of the modern bouldering in Colorado or put it on the map. Those kind of things, it doesn't even matter that he climbs V16 or whatever. Like it really is just the fact that he spread himself so wide in the climbing community and that made him a presence. And that's why Dave, people like Dave or Chris will always have a place as professional climbers, no matter where their performance goes, you know, they're really community leaders, you know, and like before them there was like Lynn Hill and those kind of people, the same way, you know, it doesn't matter that Lynn had, you know, she had a few peaks, you know, but she probably really peaked with the nose, then after that not much, but Lynn is still a very relevant name now, even if the nose stuff was over 20 years ago. It doesn't, you know, she maintained that level of being a professional in our industry. And so does Dave and so does Chris. And even though Dave and Chris still climb very hard, what matters more now is probably who they are at the crag, who they've been at the crag for 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. So to Dave's point, he was like, don't just expect to be that strong person that shows up at the crag, climbs a hard route, lowers off, cleans the draws and gets back in their car and leaves. Like maybe stay a bit, talk to some of the people, you know, belay someone or go have beer. You don't have to go drink or whatever, but like go interact with the community afterwards in some way in a handful of times. That's the point of being a person of influence and having a presence in a community is it's not only about the top peak performance that you're going to have. Of course, there is a small expectation to have that as a professional athlete, but it doesn't have to, it's not all of it.
Well, John, I want you to know that you definitely embody that or lived it every time your name comes up. You know, cause I always reach out to lots of people before we do an interview, and you know, it's just always like, oh, John's a great guy. Oh, John's awesome. You know, you definitely are out there you know, living that. But I do think it's really important.
Yeah.
And, you know, climbing is a little different than basketball, where you're not going to go down to your local place and shoot hoops and bump into Michael Jordan, but you might tie in next to, you know, a pro. And I do remember seeing Chris in Margalef and have it, you know, we all had dinner at, I can't remember, you know, whatever, like the little hotel place that everyone goes to. And just,
like the one by the river.
And just the way he handled himself, where so many people came up to him, like not just, you know, climbers, but, you know, the owner of that place. And he was just so gracious, so such a warm person to be around, and you know, left everyone like, oh yeah, Chris is a good guy, you know, and you just want to be that person. You don't want to be known as anything but that. But
yeah. And I think, you know, maybe at times it probably gets a little hard for people like Chris or Alex Honnold or Emily Heron, you know, these really high profile, because sometimes you just want to go to the bar and just hang out with your friends and your group. But they take it in stride. I think they're really very community focused people, and they're just climbers too, you know, and like and advice to young climbers who just keep being who you are as a climber, you know, like make sure that's still your priority. And, you know, you could do the gigs with the sponsors, you could do the videos and the marketing campaigns and the silly this, silly that sometimes, you know, but like that's part of that's the responsibility for sure. But try to keep your vision the way it was as genuine as it can be, you know, because that'll create a longer lasting relationship with climbing for yourself, but also for the companies. If they see that you know, you get responses like, yeah, so-and-so is a good person. I saw them at the crag. They stayed a bit longer. They supported their friend. They climbed really hard. It was super awesome. That whole package is what counts really. And that's the companies and stuff. They'll continue to contract you out if you are a person like that, I think.
Well,
dude, Tim, I'll take that advice all day.
You're a young pro. Stop being such a jerk.
Yeah.
Any
I was going to say, there's lots of thoughts. You guys have, you guys hit on a lot of great points. I'm not going to go into my opinions about all that stuff, but I do think that stuff is awesome. I think it's really relevant. One experience that I have had, I mean, yeah, there's so much to break down here, but we don't have the time for it. I'm definitely like in that web of time that you guys are talking about, you know, like I would say more like I'm 24 now. So like, you know, I would say in the last couple of years, it's definitely been a little bit different, but pre-COVID was very much like, you know, grinding for the spotlight, grinding for something, you know, getting a deal, getting something going. Like I have dreams and aspirations, like projects, places I want to be, and I need support. Like I need something to get there, or I'm going to dirtbag it, you know. But it seems to me that there is a way to get in, and like, let's figure that out. But at the same time, I love rock climbing. At the same time, I love people. At the same time, I love meeting new people and like sharing the things that I've experienced and hearing the things that people, you know, other people experience. And, you know, that's a huge reason why this podcast is so important to me. But at the same time, like I remember my experience, like, and I've talked to Josh about this a lot, but recently working with Black Diamond has been an extremely eye-opening experience for me. And, you know, it's not like something that supports me to the point where I don't have to do another job or anything ever, by no means. And we shouldn't go into that, but you know, I don't value getting another sponsorship like that, because I think I value the relationship I have with Black Diamond. And that's something that you kind of mentioned, where it's like, that's the point, isn't to get support, to give support, to do anything. It's to have that lasting relationship, because ultimately that's the one that, you know, you can create anything out of, you know, like I'm stoked to do anything with Black Diamond today just because of my relationship with them, not so much of the amount of support that I would get or, you know, even just the company itself that I like gear companies are all great. But for me, it's the relationship, you know, and like that was a huge eye-opening experience for me that I could only, you know, get once I had these connections and had these experiences and, you know, all these little trips that I value. And I'm like, well, so what's important to me nowadays? And it's like, I almost take steps backwards, you know, like where I'm like, well, what was important to me before all of this stuff, you know? And that's why now I have a completely different focus in my rock climbing. And I think for the next 10 years of my life, you know, I think every year is going to be different and all because of these types of things.
Well, yeah. Having like a good relationship with a company like that is important because you could be honest with them, you know, because it's not that people are lying or not being honest. Maybe in some cases, sure. But like, sometimes there's a lot of pressure to deliver for these companies, but the longer, the more comfortable you become with them, the more you could be honest. Like, hey, you know what? Actually, this season, I had a finger tweak. I'm just not feeling like the best, but like, you know, it's easier to be honest when you create a longing, like a longer lasting relationship, but that takes time, you know, and a little bit of sacrifice, you know, to be that involved with a company.
I love what you said about being your authentic climber self, because we're not looking for, that's kind of goes back to what you said, what made those different professionals you're around great is that they were themselves, you know, they were unique. They were interesting. They pushed the boundaries. And I think that comes through in lots of ways, not just always hard sense. So on this topic, John, did you by any chance prepare a pro tip? Did we ask you to do a pro tip or did we not?
I think, yeah. Or like we were talking about the good to great kind of thing.
I don't know, those are similar.
Well, I have a lot. I mean, well, there's some ideas of pro tips I could do, but,
yeah, I would love to, if you have a pro tip, something that you just learned through your decades, that's just a little gem that you can pass along that is useful for someone like me.
So for instance, probably I'll just work with the most recent thing. Basically in the last year, I kind of had this reflection of progress and then the Krakenet thing happened. And so it kind of shifted me to like rethink how I was training and what I was doing, and why I didn't succeed. And I would say that was a big shift for me. So kind of like the pro tip or the idea that I had that was really critical was like, don't be afraid to rethink something, you know, like just because it didn't work doesn't mean you need to just go back in the gym and hit the gym again, work harder next time. Maybe think differently of how you're going to work next time. And, you know, like just the fact that I came back and bought some books and looked at physiology and scoured the internet of like something more happened here. Like mentally I was ready. I thought I was physically ready, but I wasn't. I need to find out why, you know what I mean? And I've climbed long enough that I know I was in good shape. It's not like I was in bad shape. I was in the wrong shape or like for that short period of time, I wasn't in the shape I needed to have. So constantly rethink what you're doing season by season. Some things will stay the same, like certain basic training metrics, like a hangboard routine that, you know, really gets you out of a slump. Always do that, you know, because it's going to be constant and it works for you. But then challenge yourself a bit each season of like, you know, it didn't quite work out for me this season, so let's change things just a little bit. Always constantly challenge yourself.
So good. Tim, doesn't that kind of sound like, I feel like that's something we harp on where it's like, oh, you didn't succeed on this route or boulder. The answer is probably not that you just needed to go and do two more sets of pull-ups. You know, that's right. It's thinking differently. And I like that continual growth mindset versus like, you know, feeling like, oh, I just need to do more of what I'm doing. It's like, how can I grow? How can I tackle this problem in a different way? Good pro tip.
Yeah. We got through so many of these questions, but there's so many more that, you know, I wanted to ask and stuff we want to talk about Maybe we'll have to pick your brain somehow, but I very much appreciated all of the experiences that you shared, all the stories, all the insights. It was very live, like more so than, you know, some of the other guests that we've had. And I really appreciated that. So thank you for sharing.
Wait, Tim, I got one more. Yeah. I got one more.
You got one more. Go for it.
Just because it was, this was actually, again, from Ethan. Thank you, Ethan, for, he just spit out an email of like a million things.
Well, Ethan knows me really well, so he's probably asking all the questions.
I'm sure we'll get Ethan on again, and we'll have to ask you for some questions about him. And I actually want to kick this to you too, Tim. You've traveled a lot, John. This is kind of like open-ended, but it's like, you know, what's your kind of favorite crag out there? And also, is there any kind of crag or route or boulder that you're like, I have to do this before I die? I know those are two separate things, but I want to hear about your favorite crag because I just want to put it on my bucket list. But then it also is interesting, like hearing about what is the one place or route or boulder that you are just still coveting, because I think it speaks to your aesthetics and style and what you really are still excited about. So a little two-parter there.
Okay. Well, to begin, and this may be obvious, maybe not, but my favorite crag in the world is probably Seyouz, in France, South France. It's just in terms of the quality of rock, the general environment, the food, the culture, I can't really think of many more places. Follow up to that is maybe Sirana in Spain it just has so much, so many climbs and so much to do in Sirana. It's a very large area and it's in close circumference to a lot of cool places, like, you know, you could go to Tarragona to the beach, or you could go to Barcelona, or you could go climbing in Margalef. Bouldering, this is a tough question. I'm like answering a bunch, but I can't leave out, I mean, Waco Tanks, I grew up, you know, it's kind of in my back. I think it's one of the cooler, more unique bouldering areas in the world. But I haven't been to many, you know. I've been to France a dozen times, but I haven't been to Fontainebleau, for instance. You know, I go sport climbing generally. But I would say another big one, and Tim might agree with this, is I think Bishop is one of the better bouldering or climbing destinations in the world, just because it's so unique. It seems unlike most things out there, to be honest. It's very special.
Awesome.
We did a whole freaking
travel.
Yeah. You drive up the Bishop and it's like, you got the Sierra and you got Pine Creek down the road. I mean, it's beautiful.
It's
same way that
there.
Yosemite is to big wall climbers, maybe.
Yeah. You've definitely traveled like a bunch and you spent a lot of time like in sport crags. So I definitely trust your opinion on the best sport crags. And something you said that was really interesting about is La Rambla and Joe Mama, is that in Sirana or Oleana?
La Rambla is in Sirana, and Joe Mama is in Oleana. And Oleana is a great crag too. Yeah, but it's just a different thing, kind of.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned something about, you know, Andre's experience about like the conditions and having that being a major factor, and that kind of leads to your experience with your skin and the rock. And I think those big challenges for me is what really formed my opinion on something like Bishop, where I like Bishop not just because of, Bishop is my favorite climbing destination that I've been to, period. Not because just of the epic factor and how beautiful and stunning it is and, you know, the access and everything, but how hard it is, you know, what it's taught me as a rock climber and what I have to do in order to succeed on it. It's never easy for me, ever, you know, but I find constant creative ways to get better and better at that type of climbing. And to me, that's my favorite climbing area. And I think that will, you know, maybe change over time, but it sounds like, you know, a lot of sport climbing crags I have to go and check out for, you know, that type of practice. But also, I think, so there's, you know, two different answers that I have. You know, Bishop is for me my favorite area, but my most fun climbing so far has been in the South. My most fun climbing that I have regularly, you know, boulder to boulder, area to area, you know, place to place, just, I don't know, the vibe itself is in Chattanooga, HP40, like both times I had the most fun climbing. So my guess is also that maybe Fontainebleau or the Rocklands area, I think would be for me like the most fun climbing.
Dude,
also just that style.
Wait until you see Oleana and like Los Humildes Picasa and you're just like, oh
yeah,
that's Those are cool.
Those are world class routes. Yeah.
Yeah. So is there any route? Any route or boulder that you're like, I have to go here and do it before I die. Like, you know, what's on your bucket list there, John?
Probably. Oh man, there's a handful of routes. There's only a few boulders. it's funny. Jade was one of the boulders. I tried it on and off over the years. That kind of dabbled in. I just wanted to do it because Daniel did it, and it was kind of like of our generation, like the test piece. I don't know if anyone will be able to climb it again, actually, in its current state, with the closures and stuff. But we'll start with the roots. I mean, number one on my list of someday I definitely want to do it is Jumbo Love, mostly because of the aesthetic of the line and its like historical significance. And then going back quite a few years, I really want to go try and climb Action Direct someday. I think with just kind of my background and a lot of the routes that I pursued over the years, it would feel incomplete if I didn't climb that route. And just my general ability, I think in the next handful of years, I'll go check that one out as well.
That's cool.
Let me know if you need a Jumbo Love partner. I'm moving to Vegas and I'm.
Oh yeah. For sure.
Hit me up. I'll come out with you.
Yeah. Tim, you've been talking about
Jumbo. Yeah, I know now that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, man, Jumbo Love is definitely probably my North Star route right now.
Uh huh. Yeah. It's incredible. I actually tried it one day. And unfortunately I got injured on it. I like strained like a flexor tendon in my forearm on the upper crux. And it wasn't that bad. I recovered pretty quick, but that kind of ended the trip obviously. So I haven't been back since, and I've gathered too many projects in between that trip and now. So I need to clean up some stuff first. And boulder problems, I mean, the way I view bouldering now is like, I love it. I love a day out going bouldering and stuff, but I don't think I will necessarily pursue extremely high end bouldering, like climbs like, you know, V15 and harder. You know, it takes like a lot of dedication and specific training to get to that level again. And I think I just am at a point in my climbing where I find more joy and challenge and motivation and just longer sport climbs or sport climbs around the world. So bouldering might be more of like kind of a playful, I could see myself like pursuing bouldering trips rather and maybe not one specific climb. Like it would be great to go to Bishop again and boulder a bit, or go to the Tahoe area and go bouldering a bit, you know, that, or Rockland someday. I've never been, or Fontainebleau. But if I went to Fontainebleau, I probably wouldn't pursue the hardest boulders in the forest. I'd probably go try all the classics up to 8B or something like that, you know, as many as I could, you know. And that's how I view bouldering a bit now.
All right, you got my hands sweating good. I can't believe you've never been to Rocklands or Font.
I know, me too, honestly. I mean, they're on my list, don't get it wrong. Yeah. They've just been lower on the list.
Darn. I really do gotta wrap up because I gotta catch that flight. But John, you totally reminded me of, I was so psyched to talk about the game, not exactly like your process of doing it, but you know, you said you saw Carlo do the second ascent and you got the third, and you know, I guess we'll save that for next time, or if we can, I don't know. We'll figure out some way to get that story out of you, because that seemed like to really,
it was a cool little thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I don't know, I guess just to wrap it, actually, you know, I was going to say, because you might have done this route, my bucket list, my like route I always wanted to do is, Tom et Jarry in Verdon Gorge. Have you gone and done that? Oh man, I really want to.
I haven't. I've gone to do it twice and it's been completely wet. So I got kind of shut down. Yeah, you drive up to the point and you see it and it's like soaked. We're like, oh, we can't do it. But I have climbed in the Verdon and it's absolutely breathtaking. It's amazing. I did a couple long routes there. You know, you could climb 1500 foot routes there in a quick afternoon. It's pretty amazing. Wow. Yeah. Or a long afternoon, you know. You just get that exposure. Yeah.
It is like we were saying how I made some comment about how like dirt bagging in Europe just sounds more glamorous, but still dirt bagging. But actually, it is more glamorous. Mm-hmm. Being in Sayus and dirt bagging is way better than pitching a tent in Rifle. Sorry, Sorry, Tim.
Oh, no doubt. It is.
My standards are low. I can go have fun.
I've spent one summer in particular up in the meadows and rifle in probably like 6 weeks, like in the cow paddy shit or whatever they call it. Yeah. I don't know. The cow paddy meadows, you know, and like waking up with Ethan was there for a period of time a long time ago. Yeah.
It's awesome vibe.
All right.
All right.
John, I want to give you a chance to plug your sponsors, to say thank you, to share your Instagram handle with people, because you know, that is part of being a pro, is, you know, letting people know where to find you and keep up with you. And just thanks for coming on. But yeah, where can people find more about you if they want to?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying harder at the social thing. I do post a lot of random stuff sometimes, but I'm just John, J-O-N _ at Cardwell. And that's on Instagram and Facebook, Twitter. I don't really do much of that anymore. And I don't have a website or anything like that. So it's mostly Instagram or in person at the Crag.
You guys have to just come on here and hear from John on this podcast. But I don't blame you. It's tough to keep up all that social media, but I really like that you show up at the Crag. And, you know, you continue to make that impact on the community. I think that's underrated. And like I said, your reputation preceded you. You know, you really are accomplishing that, where people are appreciative of what you've done and have lots of great things to say about you. And I just look forward to, seeing you bust through this plateau. Hopefully I can tag along and be a belay slave. Yeah. Maybe I'll get a blue point of one of you guys on Jumbo.
Yeah, if you ever guys come through or going to Waco or something, you know, we're really close, you know. So yeah.
I love it. Awesome. I said it in my fake closer, but I very much enjoy that. Time went so fast for me. I felt like I was just listening to your brain go through a lot of the climbing and a lot of the experiences that you had. And thank you for sharing. That was awesome.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, thank you guys.
Thanks, John. Cool. Awesome. I'll have to do it again sometime. And thanks to everyone for listening.
All right. See you guys next week.
Thanks for tuning in. If you'd like to learn more about Test Piece Climbing, you can check us out at testpiececlimbing.com and even book a session with one of our coaches.